Chapter 16. Genes versus Knowledge. Old Brain, New Brain is the title of the first chapter in this book. It is also an underlying theme. Recall that 30% of our brain, the old brain, is composed of many different parts. These old brain areas control our bodily functions, basic behaviors, and emotions. Some of these behaviors and emotions cause us to be aggressive, violent, and covetous. To lie and to cheat. Every one of us harbors these tendencies to one degree or another, because evolution discovered they are useful for propagating genes. 70% of our brain, the new brain, is made of one thing, the neocortex. The neocortex learns a model of the world, and it is this model that makes us intelligent. Intelligence evolved because it, too, is useful for propagating genes. We are here as servants to our genes, but the balance of power between the old brain and new brain has started to shift. For millions of years, our ancestors had limited knowledge of our planet and the broader universe. They only understood what they could personally experience. They didn't know the size of the Earth or that it was a sphere. They didn't know what the sun, moon, planets, and stars were, and why they moved through the sky as they do. They had no idea how old the Earth is, and how its varied life forms came to be. Our ancestors were ignorant about the most basic facts of our existence. They made up stories about these mysteries, but the stories were not true. Recently, using our intelligence, we have not only solved the mysteries that vexed our ancestors, but the pace of scientific discovery is accelerating. We know how incredibly big the universe is, and how incredibly small we are. We now understand that our planet is billions of years old, and that life on Earth has been evolving also for billions of years. Fortunately, the entire universe appears to operate by one set of laws, some of which we have discovered. It appears tantalizingly possible that we might be able to discover all of them. Millions of people around the world are actively working on scientific discovery in general, and billions more feel connected to the mission. It is an incredibly exciting time to be alive. However, we have a problem that could quickly halt our race to enlightenment and might end our species entirely. Earlier, I explained that no matter how smart we become, our neocortex remains connected to the old brain. As our technologies become more and more powerful, the selfish and short-sighted behaviors of the old brain could lead us to extinction or plunge us into societal collapse and another dark age. Compounding this risk is that billions of humans still have false beliefs about the most fundamental aspects of life and the universe. Viral false beliefs are another source of behaviors that threaten our survival. We face a dilemma. We, the intelligent model of ourselves residing in the neocortex, are trapped. We are trapped in a body that is not only programmed to die, but is largely under the control of an ignorant brute, the old brain. We can use our intelligence to imagine a better future, and we can take actions to achieve the future we desire. But the old brain could ruin everything. It generates behaviors that have helped genes replicate in the past. Yet many of those behaviors are not pretty. We try to control our old brain's destructive and divisive impulses. But so far, we have not been able to do this entirely. Many countries on Earth are still ruled by autocrats and dictators whose motivations are largely driven by their old brain, wealth, sex, and alpha male type dominance. The populist movements that support autocrats are also based on old brain traits, such as racism and xenophobia. What should we do about this? In the previous chapter, I discussed ways we could preserve our knowledge in case humanity doesn't survive. In this final chapter, I discuss three methods we might pursue to prevent our demise. The first method may or may not work without modifying our genes. The second is based on gene modification, and the third abandons biology altogether. These ideas might strike you as extreme. However, ask yourself, what is the purpose of living? What are we trying to preserve when we struggle to survive? In the past, living was always about preserving and replicating genes, whether we realized it or not. But is that the best way forward? What if, instead, we decide that living should focus on intelligence and the preservation of knowledge? If we were to make that choice, then what we consider extreme today might be just the logical thing to do in the future. The three ideas that I present here are, in my opinion, possible and have a high likelihood of being pursued in the future. They may seem unlikely now, in the same way that handheld computers seemed unlikely in 1992. We will have to let time play out to see which, if any, turns out to be viable. Become a multi-planet species. When our sun dies, all life in our solar system will die too. But most extinction events that concern us would be localized to Earth. If a large asteroid hit Earth, for example, or we made it uninhabitable in a nuclear war, other nearby planets would be unaffected. Therefore, one way to lessen the risk of extinction is to become a two-planet species. If we could establish a permanent presence on another nearby planet or moon, then our species and our accumulated knowledge might survive, even if Earth became uninhabitable. This logic is one of the driving forces behind the current efforts to put people on Mars, which seems to be the best option for locating a human colony. I find the possibility of traveling to other planets exciting. It has been a long time since we have traveled to new and unexplored destinations. The main difficulty with living on Mars is that Mars is a terrible place to live. The lack of a significant atmosphere means that a short exposure outside will kill you, and a leak in your roof or a broken window could kill your entire family. Radiation from the sun is higher on Mars, and is also a major risk to living there. So you would have to continually protect yourself from the sun. Mars soil is poisonous, and there is no surface water. Seriously, it is easier to live on the South Pole than on Mars. But that doesn't mean we should give up on the idea. I believe we could live on Mars. But to do so, we need something we don't have yet. We need intelligent and autonomous robots. For humans to live on Mars, we would need large, airtight buildings to live and grow food in. We would need to extract water and minerals from mines and to manufacture air to breathe. Ultimately, we would need to terraform Mars to reintroduce an atmosphere. These are huge infrastructure projects that could take decades or centuries to complete. Until Mars became self-sufficient, we would have to send everything needed, food, air, water, medicine, tools, construction equipment, materials, and people, lots of people. All the work would have to be done wearing cumbersome spacesuits. It is hard to overstate the difficulty humans would face trying to construct livable environments and all the infrastructure needed to create a permanent, self-sustaining Mars colony. The loss of life, the psychological damage, and the financial costs would be enormous, probably larger than we are willing to endure. But preparing Mars for humans could be accomplished if, instead of sending human engineers and construction workers, we sent intelligent robotic engineers and construction workers. They would get their energy from the sun and could work outside without needing food, water, or oxygen. They could work tirelessly with no emotional stress for as long as required to make Mars safe for human habitation. The robotic corps of engineers would need to work mostly autonomously. If they relied on constant communication with Earth, progress would be too slow. I have never been a fan of science fiction literature, and this scenario sounds suspiciously like science fiction. Yet, I see no reason why we can't do this, and if we want to become a multi-planet species, I believe we have no choice. For humans to live on Mars on a permanent basis requires intelligent machines to help us. The key requirement is to endow the Mars robotic workforce with the equivalent of a neocortex. The robots need to use complex tools, manipulate materials, solve unanticipated problems, and communicate with each other, similar to how people do. I believe the only way we can achieve this is to finish reverse engineering the neocortex and create equivalent structures in silicon. Autonomous robots need to have a brain built on the principles I outlined earlier, the principles of the thousand brains theory of intelligence. Creating truly intelligent robots is achievable, and I am certain it will happen. I believe we could do this within several decades if we made it a priority. Fortunately, there are plenty of terrestrial reasons to build intelligent robots, too. Therefore, even if we don't make it a national or an international priority, market forces will eventually fund the development of machine intelligence and robotics. I hope that people around the world will come to understand that being a multi-planet species is an exciting goal, important for our survival, and that intelligent robotic construction workers are necessary to achieve it. Even if we create intelligent robotic workers, terraform Mars, and establish colonies of humans, we still have a problem. The humans who go to Mars will be just like the humans on Earth. They will have an old brain and all of the complications and risks that accompany it. Humans living on Mars will fight for territory, make decisions based on false beliefs, and probably create new existential risks for those living there. History suggests that eventually the people living on Mars and the people living on Earth will end up feuding in ways that could endanger one or both populations. For example, imagine that 200 years from now, 10 million humans are living on Mars. But then, something goes bad on Earth. Perhaps we accidentally poison most of the planet with radioactive elements, or Earth's climate starts rapidly failing. What would happen? Billions of Earth inhabitants might suddenly want to move to Mars. If you let your imagination run a bit, you can see how this could easily turn out badly for everyone. I don't want to speculate on negative outcomes, but it is important to recognize that becoming a multi-planet species is no panacea. Humans are humans, and the problems we create on Earth will also exist on other planets we inhabit. What about becoming a multi-stellar species? If humans could colonize other star systems, then we could expand throughout the galaxy, and the chance that some of our descendants would survive indefinitely would increase dramatically. Is interstellar human travel possible? On the one hand, it seems like it should be. There are 4 stars that are less than 5 light-years from us, and 11 stars less than 10 light-years away. Einstein showed that it is impossible to accelerate to the speed of light, so let's say we travel at half that speed. Then a mission to a nearby star could be accomplished in a decade or two. On the other hand, we don't know how to get anywhere close to this speed. Using the technologies we have today, it would take tens of thousands of years to reach our nearest neighboring star. Humans cannot make that long a trip. There are many physicists thinking of clever ways to overcome the problems of interstellar flight. Perhaps they will discover ways to travel close to the speed of light, or even faster than it. Many things that seemed impossible just 200 years ago are now commonplace. Imagine that you spoke at a meeting of scientists in 1820 and said that in the future, anyone could travel in comfort from continent to continent in a matter of hours, or that people would routinely hold face-to-face conversations with other people anywhere in the world by looking at and speaking to their hand. Nobody would have thought these activities would ever be possible. But here we are. The future will certainly surprise us with new advances that today are inconceivable, and one of them may be practical space travel. But I feel comfortable in predicting that human interstellar travel will not happen in less than 50 years. I would not be surprised if it never happened. I still advocate for becoming a multi-planet species. It will be an inspiring exploratory adventure, and it might reduce the near-term risk of humans going extinct. But the inherent risks and limitations that arise from our evolutionary heritage remain. Even if we manage to establish colonies on Mars, we may have to accept that we will never venture beyond our solar system. However, we have other options. These require us to look at ourselves objectively and ask, what is it about humanity we are trying to preserve? I'll address that question first, before discussing 2 more options for securing our future. Choosing our future. Starting with the Enlightenment at the end of the 18th century, we have accumulated increasing evidence that the universe progresses without a guiding hand. The emergence of simple life, then complex organisms, and then intelligence was neither planned nor inevitable. Similarly, the future of life on Earth and the future of intelligence are not predetermined. It appears that the only thing in the universe that cares how our future unfolds is us. The only desirable future is the one that we desire. You might object to this statement. You might say that there are many other species living on Earth, some also intelligent. We have harmed many of these species and caused others to go extinct. Shouldn't we consider what other species desire? Yes, but it's not so simple. Earth is dynamic. The tectonic plates that make its surface are constantly moving, creating new mountains, new continents, and new seas while plunging existing features into the Earth's center. Life is similarly dynamic. Species are ever-changing. We are not the same genetically as our ancestors who lived 100,000 years ago. The rate of change may be slow, but it never stops. If you look at Earth this way, then it doesn't make sense to try to preserve species or to preserve Earth. We cannot stop the Earth's most basic geological features from changing, and we can't stop species from evolving and going extinct. One of my favorite activities is wilderness hiking, and I consider myself to be an environmentalist. But I don't pretend that environmentalism is about preserving nature. Every environmentalist would be happy to see the extinction of some living things, say the polio virus, while simultaneously going to great lengths to save an endangered wildflower. From the universe's perspective, this is an arbitrary distinction. Neither the polio virus nor the wildflower is better or worse than the other. We make the choice about what to protect based on what is in our best interest. Environmentalism is not about preserving nature, but about the choices we make. As a rule, environmentalists make choices that benefit future humans. We try to slow down changes to the things we like, such as wilderness areas, to increase the chances that our descendants can also enjoy these things. There are other people who would choose to turn wilderness areas into strip mines so that they can benefit today, more of an old brain choice. The universe doesn't care which option we choose. It is our choice whether we help future humans or present humans. There is no option to do nothing. As intelligent beings, we must make choices, and our choices will steer the future one way or another. As to the other animals on Earth, we can choose to help them or not. But as long as we are here, there is no option to let things go their natural way. We are part of nature, and we must make choices that will impact the future. As I see it, we have a profound choice to make. It is a choice between favoring the old brain or the new brain. More specifically, do we want our future to be driven by the processes that got us here, namely natural selection, competition, and the drive of selfish genes? Or do we want our future to be driven by intelligence and the desire to understand the world? We have the opportunity to choose between a future where the primary driver is the creation and dissemination of knowledge, and a future where the primary driver is the copying and dissemination of genes. To exercise our choice, we need the ability to change the course of evolution by manipulating genes, and the ability to create intelligence in non-biological form. We already have the former, and the latter is imminent. Use of these technologies has led to ethical debates. Should we manipulate the genes of other species to improve our food supply? Should we manipulate our own genes to improve our progeny? Should we create intelligent machines that are smarter and more capable than we are? Perhaps you have already formed opinions on these questions. You might think that these things are fine, or you might think that they are unethical. Regardless, I don't see any harm in discussing our options. Looking carefully at our choices will help us make informed decisions, no matter what we choose to do. Becoming a multi-planet species is an attempt to prevent our extinction, but it is still a future dictated by genes. What kind of choices could we make to favor the propagation of knowledge over the propagation of genes? Modify our genes. we have recently developed the technology to precisely edit DNA molecules. Soon, we will be able to create new genomes and modify existing ones with the precision and ease of creating and editing text documents. The benefits of gene editing could be huge. For example, we could eliminate inherited diseases that cause suffering in millions of people. However, the same technology can also be used to design entirely new life forms or to modify our children's DNA. For example, to make them better athletes or more attractive. Whether we think this kind of manipulation is okay or abhorrent depends on the circumstances. Modifying our DNA to make us look more attractive seems unnecessary. But if gene editing keeps our entire species from going extinct, then it becomes an imperative. For example, let's say we decide that establishing a colony on Mars is a good insurance plan for the long-term survival of our species, and many people sign up to go. But then we discover that humans cannot live on Mars for extended periods of time due to the low gravity. We already know that spending months in zero gravity on the International Space Station leads to medical problems. Perhaps after 10 years of living in the low gravity of Mars, our bodies start failing and die. A permanent population on Mars would then seem impossible. However, let's say we could fix this problem by editing the human genome, and people with these DNA modifications could live indefinitely on Mars. Should we allow people to edit their genes and the genes of their children so that they can live on Mars? Anyone willing to go to Mars is already accepting life-threatening risks, and the genes of people living on Mars will slowly change anyway. So why shouldn't people be able to make that choice? If you think this form of gene editing should be forbidden, would you change your mind if Earth was becoming uninhabitable and the only way you could survive at all was to move to Mars? Now, imagine we learn how to modify our genes to eliminate aggressive behavior and make a person more altruistic. Should we allow this? Consider that when we select who gets to be an astronaut, we pick people who naturally have these attributes. There is a good reason we do this. It increases the likelihood that a space mission succeeds. If in the future we send people to live on Mars, we will likely do the same type of screening. Wouldn't we give preference to emotionally stable people over people with a short fuse and a history of aggression? When a single careless or violent act could kill an entire community, wouldn't the people already living on Mars demand that new arrivals pass some sort of emotional stability test? If we could make a better citizen by editing DNA, the existing Mars inhabitants might insist on that. Consider one more hypothetical scenario. Some fish can survive being frozen in ice. What if we could modify our DNA so that a human could similarly be frozen and then thawed sometime in the future? I can imagine many people would want to freeze their body to be woken up again in 100 years. It would be thrilling to live out the last 10 or 20 years of your life in the future. Would we allow it? What if this modification allowed humans to travel to other stars? Even if the trip took thousands of years, our space travelers could be frozen on departure and thawed when they got to their destination. There would be no shortage of volunteers for such a trip. Are there reasons we should forbid the DNA modifications that would make such a voyage possible? I can come up with many scenarios where we might decide it is in our best personal interest to significantly modify our DNA. There is no absolute right or wrong. There are only choices that we get to make. If people say we should never allow DNA editing on principle, then whether they realize it or not, they have chosen a future that is in the best interests of our existing genes, or, as is often the case, of viral false beliefs. By taking such a stand, they are eliminating choices that might be in the best interest of the long-term survival of humanity and the long-term survival of knowledge. I am not advocating that we should edit the human genome with no oversight or deliberation, and nothing I have described involves coercion. No one should ever be forced to do any of these things. I am only pointing out that gene editing is possible, and therefore we have choices. Personally, I don't see why the path of unguided evolution is preferable over a path of our own choosing. We can be thankful that evolutionary processes got us here. But now that we are here, we have the option to use our intelligence to take control of the future. Our survival as a species and the survival of our knowledge might be more secure if we do. A future designed by editing our DNA is still a biological future, and that imposes limits on what is possible. For example, it is unclear how much can be accomplished by DNA editing. Will it be possible to edit our genome to allow future humans to travel between the stars? Will it be possible to make future humans that don't kill each other on a remote planetary outpost? No one knows. Today, we don't have enough knowledge about DNA to predict what is possible and what is not. I would not be surprised if we found that some of the things we might want to do are impossible in principle. Now I turn to our final option. It is perhaps the surest way to guarantee the preservation of knowledge and the survival of intelligence, but it might also be the most difficult. Leaving Darwin's orbit. The ultimate way to free our intelligence from the grip of our old brain and our biology is to create machines that are intelligent like us, but not dependent upon us. They would be intelligent agents that could travel beyond our solar system and survive longer than we will. These machines would share our knowledge, but not our genes. If humans should regress culturally, as in a new dark age, or if we become extinct, our intelligent machine progeny would continue on without us. I hesitate to use the word machine because it might invoke an image of something like a computer sitting on a desk, or a humanoid robot, or some evil character from a science fiction story. As I described earlier, we cannot predict what intelligent machines will look like in the future. In the same way that the early designers of computers couldn't imagine what future computers would look like. No one in the 1940s imagined that computers could be smaller than a grain of rice, small enough to be embedded into nearly everything. Nor could they imagine powerful cloud computers that are accessible everywhere, but not exactly located anywhere. Similarly, we cannot imagine what intelligent machines of the future will look like, or what they will be made of. So let's not try. It might limit our thinking of what is possible. Instead, let's discuss two reasons why we might want to create intelligent machines that can travel to the stars without us. Goal number one, preserve knowledge. In the previous chapter, I described how we might preserve knowledge in a repository orbiting the sun. I labeled this WikiEarth. The repository I described was static. It is like a library of printed books floating in space. Our goal in creating it would be to preserve knowledge, with the hope that some future intelligent agent discovers the repository and figures out how to read its contents. However, without humans actively looking after its maintenance, the repository will slowly decay. WikiEarth does not make copies of itself, does not repair itself, and therefore is temporary. We would design it to last a long time, but at some point in the distant future, it would cease to be readable. The human neocortex is also like a library. It contains knowledge about the world. But unlike WikiEarth, the neocortex makes copies of what it knows by transferring its knowledge to other humans. For example, this book is an attempt by me to transfer some things I know to other people, like you. This ensures that knowledge is distributed. The loss of any one person will not lead to the permanent loss of knowledge. The surest way to preserve knowledge is to continually make copies. Therefore, one goal of creating intelligent machines would be to replicate what humans are already doing, preserving knowledge by making and distributing copies. We would want to use intelligent machines for this purpose because they could continue preserving knowledge long after we are gone. And they can distribute knowledge to places we can't go, such as other stars. Unlike humans, intelligent machines could slowly spread across the galaxy. They hopefully would be able to share knowledge with intelligent beings elsewhere in the universe. Imagine how exciting it would be if we discovered a repository of knowledge and galactic history that had traveled to our solar system. In the previous chapter on estate planning, I described both the Wiki Earth idea and the idea of creating a long-lasting signal to indicate that we, an intelligent species, once existed in our solar system. Together, these two systems could potentially direct other intelligent beings to our solar system, and then to the discovery of our knowledge repository. What I am proposing in this chapter is a different way of achieving a similar result. Instead of directing an alien intelligence to the repository of knowledge in our solar system, we send copies of our knowledge and history throughout the galaxy. Either way, something that is intelligent must make the long trip through space. Everything wears down. As intelligent machines travel through space, some will be damaged, lost, or unintentionally destroyed. Therefore, our intelligent machine progeny must be able to repair themselves and, when needed, make copies of themselves. I realize this will scare people who worry about intelligent machines taking over the world. As I explained earlier, I don't believe we have to worry about this, as most intelligent machines won't be able to make copies of themselves. But in this scenario, it is a requirement. However, it is so hard for intelligent machines to replicate that it is the main reason this scenario might not be possible. Imagine a handful of intelligent machines traveling through space. After thousands of years, they arrive at a new solar system. They find mostly barren planets and one planet with primitive single-celled life. This is what would have been found by a visitor to our solar system a few billion years ago. Now, let's say the intelligent machines decided they needed to replace two of their members and create a few new intelligent machines to send off to another star. How could they do this? If, for example, the machines were built using silicon chips like the ones we use in computers, then would they need to build silicon chip manufacturing plants and all the necessary supply chains? This might be infeasible. Perhaps we will learn how to create intelligent machines that are able to replicate using common elements, similar to carbon-based life on Earth. I don't know how to overcome the many practical problems that interstellar travel presents, but once again, I believe we shouldn't focus on the physical manifestations of future intelligent machines. There may be ways of building intelligent machines using materials and construction methods that we have not yet invented. For now, it is more important to discuss goals and concepts to help us decide if this is something we would choose to do if we could. If we decide that sending intelligent machines to explore the galaxy and spread knowledge is something we want to pursue, then it is possible we could devise ways of overcoming the obstacles. Goal number 2. Acquire new knowledge. If we managed to create self-sustaining intelligent machines that traveled between stars, they would discover new things. They would undoubtedly discover new types of planets and stars and make other discoveries that we can't imagine. Perhaps they would discover the answers to deep mysteries about the universe, such as its origin or destiny. That is the nature of exploration. You don't know what you will learn, but you will learn something. If we sent humans to explore the galaxy, we would expect them to make discoveries. In many ways, intelligent machines will be more capable of discovery than humans. Their brain equivalent will have more memory, work faster, and have novel sensors. They would be better scientists than we are. If intelligent machines traversed our galaxy, they would continually increase what is known about the universe. A future with purpose and direction. Humans have long dreamed about traveling between the stars. Why? One reason is to extend and preserve our genes. This is based on the idea that the destiny of a species is to continually explore new lands and establish colonies wherever it can. We have done this repeatedly in the past, traveling over mountains and across oceans to establish new societies. This serves the interests of our genes, and therefore we are programmed to explore. Curiosity is one of our old brain functions. It is hard to resist exploring, even when it would be safer not to. If humans could travel to the stars, it would just be an extension of what we have always done, spreading our genes to as many places as possible. The second reason, the one I have suggested in this chapter, is to extend and preserve our knowledge. This line of thinking is based on the assumption that intelligence, not our particular genes, is why our species is important. Therefore, we should travel to the stars to learn more and safeguard our knowledge for the future. But is that a better choice? What is wrong with continuing on, as we always have? We could forget all this chatter about preserving knowledge or creating intelligent machines. Life on Earth has been pretty good so far. If humans can't travel to other stars, so what? Why not just continue on as we have and enjoy the ride while it lasts? That is a reasonable choice, and in the end, it may be our only one. But I want to make the case for knowledge over genes. There is a fundamental difference between the two, a difference that makes preserving and spreading knowledge, in my opinion, a more worthy goal than preserving and spreading our genes. Genes are just molecules that replicate. As genes evolve, they are not heading in any particular direction, nor is one gene intrinsically better than another, just as one molecule is not intrinsically better than any other molecule. Some genes may be better at replication. Yet, as environments change, which genes are better at replicating also changes. Importantly, there is no overall direction to the changes. Life based on genes has no direction or goal. Life may manifest itself as a virus, a single-celled bacterium, or a tree. But there doesn't appear to be any reason to suggest one life form is better than another, beyond its ability to replicate. Knowledge is different. Knowledge has both a direction and an end goal. For example, consider gravity. In the not-too-distant past, nobody had any idea why things fell down and not up. Newton created the first successful theory of gravity. He proposed that it is a universal force, and he showed that it behaves according to a set of simple laws that could be expressed mathematically. After Newton, we would never go back to having no theory of gravity. Einstein's explanation of gravity is better than Newton's, and we will never go back to Newton's theory. It wasn't that Newton was wrong. His equations still accurately describe gravity as we experience it every day. Einstein's theory incorporates Newton's, but better describes gravity under unusual conditions. There is a direction to knowledge. Knowledge of gravity can go from no knowledge to Newton's to Einstein's, but it can't go in the opposite direction. In addition to a direction, knowledge has an end goal. The earliest human explorers did not know how big the Earth was. No matter how far they traveled, there was always more. Was the Earth infinite? Did it end with an edge where further travel would cause you to fall off? Nobody knew, but there was an end goal. It was assumed that there was an answer to the question, how big is the Earth? We eventually achieved that goal with a surprising answer. The Earth is a sphere, and now we know how big the Earth is. We are facing similar mysteries today. How big is the universe? Does it go on forever? Does it have an edge? Does it wrap around on itself like the Earth? Are there many universes? There are plenty of other things we don't understand. What is time? How did life originate? How common is intelligent life? Answering these questions is a goal, and history suggests we can achieve it. A future driven by genes has little to no direction and only short-term goals. Stay healthy, have kids, enjoy life. A future designed in the best interest of knowledge has both direction and end goals. The good news is we don't have to choose one future over the other. It is possible to do both. We can continue to live on Earth, doing our best to keep it livable and trying to protect ourselves from our own worst behaviors. And we can simultaneously dedicate resources to ensuring the preservation of knowledge and the continuation of intelligence for a time in the future when we are no longer here. I wrote part 3 of this book, the last 5 chapters, to make a case for knowledge over genes. I asked you to look at humans objectively. I asked you to see how we make poor decisions and why our brains are susceptible to false beliefs. I asked you to consider knowledge and intelligence as more precious than genes and biology, and therefore worthy of preservation beyond their current home in our biological brain. I asked you to consider the possibility of progeny based on intelligence and knowledge, and that these descendants might be equally worthy to ones based on genes. I want to emphasize again that I am not prescribing what we should do. My goal is to encourage discussion, to point out that some things we think of as ethical certainties are actually choices, and to bring some undeserved ideas to the forefront. Now I want to return to the present. Final thoughts. I have a vision that never ceases to entertain me. I imagine the vast universe, with its hundreds of billions of galaxies. Each galaxy contains hundreds of billions of stars. Around each star, I picture planets of limitless variety. I imagine these trillions of monstrously sized objects slowly orbiting each other in the vast emptiness of space for billions of years. What amazes me is that the only thing in the universe that knows about this, the only thing that knows that the universe exists at all, is our brain. If it wasn't for brains, then nothing would know that anything exists. It prompts the question that I mentioned at the beginning of the book. If there is no knowledge of something, can we say that the thing exists at all? That our brain plays such a unique role is fascinating. Of course, there may be intelligent beings elsewhere in the universe, but this makes it even more entertaining to think about. Thinking about the universe and the uniqueness of intelligence is one of the reasons I wanted to study the brain. But there are plenty of other reasons right here on Earth. For example, understanding how the brain works has implications for medicine and mental health. Solving the brain's mysteries will lead to true machine intelligence, which will benefit all aspects of society in the same way that computers did. And it will lead to better methods of teaching our children. But ultimately, it comes back to our unique intelligence. We are the most intelligent species. If we want to understand who we are, then we have to understand how the brain creates intelligence. Reverse engineering the brain and understanding intelligence is, in my opinion, the most important scientific quest humans will ever undertake. When I started on this quest, I had a limited understanding of what the neocortex did. I and other neuroscientists had some notions about the brain learning a model of the world, but our notions were vague. We didn't know what such a model would look like or how neurons could create it. We were awash in experimental data, and it was difficult to make sense of the data without a theoretical framework. Since that time, neuroscientists around the world have made significant progress. This book focuses on what my team has learned. Much of it has been surprising, like the revelation that the neocortex doesn't contain one model of the world, but about 150,000 sensory motor modeling systems, or the discovery that everything the neocortex does is based on reference frames. In the first part of this book, I describe the new theory of how the neocortex works and how it learns a model of the world. We call this the Thousand Brains Theory of Intelligence. I hope my exposition was clear and that you found my arguments compelling. At one point, I debated whether I should end right there. A framework for understanding the neocortex is certainly ambitious enough for one book. However, understanding the brain naturally leads to other issues of consequence, so I kept going. In part two, I argued that today's AI is not intelligent. True intelligence requires machines to learn a model of the world the same way the neocortex does. And I made the case for why machine intelligence is not an existential risk, as many others believe. Machine intelligence will be one of the most beneficial technologies we will ever create. Like every other technology, there will be people who abuse it. I worry more about that than AI itself. On its own, machine intelligence does not represent an existential risk. And the benefits, I believe, will be far greater than the downsides. Finally, in part three of the book, I looked at the human condition, through the lens of intelligence and brain theory. As you can probably tell, I am concerned about the future. I am concerned about the welfare of human society and even the long-term survival of our species. One of my goals is to raise awareness of how the combination of the old brain and false beliefs is a real existential risk, far greater than the presumed threat of AI. I discussed different ways we might reduce the risks we face. Several of them require that we create intelligent machines. I wrote this book to convey what my colleagues and I have learned about intelligence and the brain. But beyond sharing this information, I hope to convince some of you to act on it. If you're young or contemplating a career change, consider entering the fields of neuroscience and machine intelligence. There are few subjects more interesting, more challenging, and more important. However, I must warn you, it will be difficult if you want to pursue the ideas that I wrote about in this book. Both neuroscience and machine learning are large fields with tremendous inertia. I have little doubt that the principles I described here will play central roles in both areas of research, but it might take years to happen. In the meantime, you will have to be determined and resourceful. I have one more ask, which applies to everyone. I hope that one day every person on Earth will learn how their brain works. To me, this should be an expectation, like, oh, you have a brain. Here is what you need to know about it. The list of things everyone should know is short. I would include how the brain is composed of the new part and the older parts. I would include how the neocortex learns a model of the world, whereas the older parts of the brain generate our emotions and more primitive behaviors. I would include how the old brain can take control, causing us to act in ways we know we shouldn't. And I would include how all of us are susceptible to false beliefs, and how some beliefs are viral. I believe everyone should know these things, in the same way that everyone should know that the Earth orbits the Sun, and that DNA molecules encode our genes, and that dinosaurs lived on Earth for millions of years, but are now extinct. This is important. Many of the problems we face, from wars to climate change, are created by false beliefs, or the selfish desires of the old brain, or both. If every human understood what was going on in their head, I believe we would have fewer conflicts and a sunnier prognosis for our future. Each of us can contribute to this effort. If you're a parent, teach your children about brains, in the same way you might hold up an orange and apple to teach your children about the solar system. If you write children's books, consider writing about the brain and beliefs. If you are an educator, ask how brain theory can be included as part of a core curriculum. Many communities now teach genetics and DNA technologies as a standard part of their high school curricula. I believe brain theory is equally, if not more, important. What are we? How did we get here? What is our destiny? For millennia, our ancestors have asked these fundamental questions. This is natural. We wake up and find ourselves in a complex and mysterious world. There is no instruction manual to life and no history or backstory to explain what it is all about. We do our best to make sense of our situation. But for most of human history, we have been ignorant. Beginning a few hundred years ago, we started answering some of these fundamental questions. We now understand the chemistry underlying all living things. We understand the evolutionary processes that led to our species, and we know that our species will continue to evolve and will likely become extinct sometime in the future. Similar questions can be asked about us as mental beings. What makes us intelligent and self-aware? How did our species become intelligent? What is the destiny of intelligence and knowledge? I hope I have convinced you that not only are these questions answerable, but we are making excellent progress in answering them. I hope I have also convinced you that we should be concerned about the future of intelligence and knowledge, independent of our concern about the future of our species. Our superior intelligence is unique, and as far as we know, the human brain is the only thing in the universe that knows the broader universe exists. It is the only thing that knows the size of the universe, its age, and the laws by which it operates. This makes our intelligence and knowledge worthy of preservation, and it gives us hope that one day we may understand everything. We are Homo sapiens, the wise humans. Hopefully, we will be wise enough to recognize how special we are, wise enough to make the choices that ensure our species survives as long as possible here on Earth, and wise enough to make the choices that ensure that intelligence and knowledge survive even longer, here on Earth and throughout the universe. This has been a Hachette Audio production of 1,000 Brains, A New Theory of Intelligence, written by Jeff Hawkins with a foreword by Richard Dawkins, read by Jamie Rennell and Richard Dawkins. Produced by Stephanie Chicatiello, directed by Greg Cooler. Post-production by Listen Up. Production supervised by Elise Green. 1,000 Brains is also available in print and as an ebook from Basic Books, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2021 by Jeffrey C. Hawkins. Forward copyright 2021 by Richard Dawkins. Audio production copyright 2021 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.